Today is a book by James Robison called The Stream, and if you're not familiar with it, there is actually thestream.org, which is a new website that he started in January, and all sorts of people that I have such respect for actually provide that as kind of a news alternative. But this book is really kind of set forth on the assumption that we're losing our country. Did you hear Pastor Graham talk about that today? And so in some respects, what can we do about that? And so I thought I would just kind of go through some of this today, and you might want to get a copy of the book, or else I would be glad to make a CD available, because Dr. James Robison met with us. And by the way, if some of you were asking about that, there are 25 members of this Evangelical Advisory Board for Donald Trump. James Robison is on that list, and of course Jack Graham is on that list, as well as David Jeremiah and Jim Dobson, and it's kind of a who's who. As a matter of fact, I read the list off yesterday and realized about two-thirds of the individuals on that list I've interviewed on Point of View. They're the kind of people that we would certainly appreciate. And James Robison just recently wrote a piece about why he felt that it might be good to provide spiritual counsel. Of course, we heard Pastor Graham talk about that today. So be in prayer for those individuals, and we'll see what happens in that regard. But I want to get into this book a little bit. And if you have a handout, you'll notice that there are some brief outlines, and really those subpoints are chapters in the book. And they're written in a fairly short format. So if you decide to get the book, you might want to read maybe a chapter a day or something like that. It would be just something that be a real encouragement. But it really is about this idea of the restoration of Christian faith in America. And because we've lost our foundations, that is the case. And it really sets forth restoration, you know, what we need to do personally as believers and how we need to live, but also corporately what we can do as the church, and even sets forth a couple of various other issues as well. So I broke the chapters down very quickly into kind of three categories, as you can see: spiritual solutions, and then sort of political economic solutions, although I've only taken a few of those, and then some cultural and social solutions. And just wanted to get you thinking about this, and if you're looking for, again, a book that would be of interest, that would certainly be the case. Early on in the book, James Robison talks about in the Constitutional Convention, when they were having the Constitutional Convention, George Washington sat on this chair, and it may be a little harder to see on the screen there, but you can look at it if you look at it on your tablet or your other kinds of maybe smartphones, that there is a sun that was in that chair, and there was also a painting of a sunrise. And it was interesting that James Madison, who was the individual taking notes on the Constitutional Convention, said at one point Benjamin Franklin, after looking at the chair and looking at the painting, said, you know, "I've often looked at the sun behind the president without being able to tell whether it was a rising sun or a setting sun." He said, "Now I know it is a rising sun." But one of the things James Robison said, and I think Pastor Graham reiterated today, is some of us wonder if we are in a culture and a country where it's a setting sun. And so in some respects, it brings us back to some of the needs. And one of the things James Robison talks about in the book is that we really have a time in which there is tremendous healing, a need for tremendous healing. He said you can look at Ferguson, you can look at the riots in Baltimore, and you can even this week realize we had a sit-in in the United States House of Representatives, and you can see the conflicts that are in some of these political rallies. And so if you needed any evidence at all that we certainly are at a time in which this nation needs healing, this is certainly the case. And one of the key passages, of course, that you might want to put in your notes would be Romans 1 verses 18 to 32. And this is here, interestingly enough, where the Apostle Paul is writing to the church in Rome. And as a matter of fact, one of the things we did in our tour recently is actually go to the place where most likely we think Paul wrote that book to the Romans. And it's actually a nice seashore. But anyway, even as he is reflecting on what is happening just down the road from Corinth, he's been to Philippi, he's been to Athens, he wants to go to Rome. He's reflecting on, if you will, kind of the degradation of the civilization that he finds himself in. And three separate times says God gave them over. And so, again, you can recognize that this is not the first time a nation might have been in decline. But nevertheless, we see that here we had a nation that was established by the founders and the framers of the Constitution that really established it upon a godly foundation. And yet today we can see such a movement to really remove God from government, to remove God from society. And so one of the quotes that I wanted to give you, and you, I might just mention later, if you wanted to study this a little bit more, if you're one of the visitors we were talking about, you can see on the bottom of your handout that it says PrestonwoodExamined.org. And so all of these quotes are available there in case you wanted to use them on a Facebook page or something like that. One of the quotes I'd never heard, and I've read quite a number of the founders, was this one that came, interesting enough, from James Madison. James Madison, oftentimes referred to as the architect of the Constitution, but he really called upon America to trust in the guardianship and guidance of that almighty being whose power regulates the destiny of nations. Dispense to this rising republic and to whom we are bound to address our devout gratitude for the past as well as our fervent supplications and best hopes for the future. And so really what he, I think, sets forth there, and in many of his writings, as well as the writings of George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, as well as Benjamin Rush, and all these individuals that were our founders, was the idea that we should really entrust the future of America on God, and we should be fervently praying for his blessings that would come to us and trust in his divine providence. And of course we can see how very far away that is as well. One of the things we talked about on Friday with Kelly Shackelford is an individual who actually was going to a flag folding ceremony. Now this is a private flag folding ceremony for the retirement of somebody in the Air Force, where he invited one of his friends to actually give the flag folding ceremony. And the minute this individual mentioned the word God, these individuals picked him up and dragged him out of the military ceremony. Can you think about that? I mean, this is the same military which George Washington, our founder, established the chaplaincy so that people would hear about God. And in this particular, by the way, the Air Force has said, yeah, I think we made a real mistake. Do you think? But nevertheless, you know, a person dragged out of a flag folding retirement ceremony, which by the way was a private ceremony. Yes, it was on the base, but it was a private ceremony. It was never in us. Just as soon as you hear the word God, it was like somebody used a pornographic word and he was dragged out of there. And it illustrates again how far we've come even in this country. One of the points that James Robinson makes is that really a lot of this happens when most people disagree with it. And he's got a whole long list. I only put a few of those up there. But he has a whole little section there called most people. He says most people don't like what's happening to this country. Most people want change. Most people are concerned about the national direction. They're concerned about the economy. They're concerned about the future. Most people are angry about the inaction and ineffectiveness of Congress and other leaders. So the point is it isn't like there's this majority driving where the country is going. Most people oftentimes have some real concerns about the direction of this country. And so it's a reminder again that maybe we as individuals who represent, I think, the grassroots need to, wherever we can in our sphere of influence, make a difference. Well, that brings us to one of the key chapters, and that is the issue of a spiritual awakening. The United States was born, in many cases, out of a first great awakening. This is Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield. And it's really almost impossible to consider what happened in the American Revolution without looking at what preceded it with the first great awakening. Then after that time, there was a second great awakening that took place as well. And I'll spend a little bit of time next week, if you come out and listen to somebody dressed in various historical garb, talking about the influence of those and also the influence of some of that in our nation. But again, we can only see a new day, says James Robinson, if we do have a spiritual awakening. We can't fix things without God's wisdom. You know, what we really need, he says, is a bottom-up, inside-out, internal change. And one of the things he says, you know, certainly government assistance will work, and it can be executed without the gospel, but it will never be fully successful, because even if you were smart enough to discover life principles, because there is common grace, you know, people that don't have the Bible sometimes find biblical truth just because it's available. You know, rational people can discover biblical truth. But even if you discover those life principles, you won't have the power to apply them. And so that's why he is convinced that even if we have individuals that use wise thinking and maybe even discover life principles, it's never going to be as effective unless we have a spiritual awakening. And if you think about this, that is going to be dependent upon the church. Again, I love the fact that Pastor Graham today talked about the importance of the church. Yes, the bride of Christ is flawed. Every church has its flaws. But nevertheless, if you think about historically, and that's one of the things we'll talk about a little bit more next week, what caused such remarkable changes in America, almost always they were either started in the churches or they flourished by the churches. And that would be the suffrage movement and the abolition movement and the temperance movement and all sorts of very significant social movements either were started in the church or else flourished because godly people inside the church took those on. He says, today, even so, the church is still the primary source of strength in the communities. Think about a consolation after the loss of a loved one. You know, people that are very secular, all of a sudden, when they've lost a loved one, where do they go? Do they go to the Department of Homeland Security to get consolation? Do they go to the Defense Department to have someone minister to their needs? No, they go to the church. By the way, I'm sorry we weren't here last week, but we were in the midst of doing a funeral for Suzanne's father. And it is amazing when I look out there, because I got a chance to do part of that funeral and that memorial service, there are just a lot of non-believers in that particular group. People that only come to church when somebody dies. You know, and I know some of these, and some of them are in Suzanne's family, and I'm just glad they're there. You know, when it came time to begin to find some consolation for the loss of a loved one, where do they go? They come to the church. For some of those people, I think it's only the second time they've been in that church. You know, first with the loss of her mother, loss of her father, but that's okay. They got to hear the gospel. Many times got to get various tracts. We'll see where it happens there. And I know your story from Miami is a good example there with your mother. So, I mean, we've got all sorts of great stories like this. But look where the people go when they need consolation. Food for the hungry, clothes for the needy, shelter for the homeless. And so, if anything, we should actually be empowering local churches, not assaulting religious liberty. And every single Friday on my program, we have Kelly Shackelford, or if he's not there, we'll have Jay Sekulow or somebody just talking about all the various threats to religious liberty we're facing in America. Two other aspects that he talked about in the book, and I'm going through this book pretty quickly, and if James Robinson were sitting there, he'd say, wait a minute, you forgot. Yeah, I know. But we're trying to end on time here. But there are two other points he mentions, and that is not only praying for a spiritual revival and praying for an awakening, but one of the other factors is gratitude. If you think about that, certainly that is the case. When you look at times in which God has moved in this country, think, for example, of the Thanksgiving celebration in 1621 with the Pilgrims. Think of the great Thanksgiving proclamation by Abraham Lincoln in 1863. Those of us that traveled over to Greece were able to actually see most likely where the prison was that Paul was in Philippi. And this is after he and Silas have been beaten. And yet at midnight, what are they doing? They're singing hymns. They're showing gratitude, nevertheless, singing praises as well. So gratitude, very important. Another part is wisdom. We really need to begin to talk about wisdom. And if you've ever been around James Robinson, he uses the phrase wisdom so often. I can't think of a time where I've done an interview with him where he doesn't spend lots of time talking about godly wisdom or biblical wisdom. And in a culture where we have so much knowledge, it's really important, I think, for us to really understand that we need to be seeking God God's Word and finding wisdom in our lives as well. So that's kind of a brief summary of some of the spiritual chapters in his book. But let me for just a few minutes talk about some of the political ones, because again, those also are founded in biblical principles. And the first one simply is this idea of freedom. Again, a phrase that he uses so often is freedom. As a matter of fact, he includes one of the messages he gave when Ronald Reagan was running for president back in 1980. He brought all sorts of religious leaders to a session where they had Ronald Reagan speaking, but he even included one of his speeches. And a number of times he uses the word freedom, I thought was kind of intriguing. One of the key verses, of course, is Galatians 5:1. And if you wanted to have a quiet time this week, spend a little bit of time in chapter 5 and see the number of times the Apostle Paul uses the word freedom. Now, of course, he's talking about freedom from legalism, freedom from people that had the law and wanted to put Christians back under the law. But I think it's interesting to see freedom in a broader context as well, because at that time, you really didn't have much freedom in the Roman Empire, especially if you were a slave. So freedom had to be in a narrow sense. But if you look at freedom in the broader sense, we today, I think as Americans, take freedom for granted, don't you? If you go to countries where they don't have the kind of freedom we have, you realize we have taken a lot of freedom for granted. Your decision about where you're going to go to lunch today, for example. Your decision about who you're going to vote for this November. Your decision about which particular job you're going to have is simply something we take for granted. But this week, this last week, I had a chance to interview Virginia Prodan, and her book is entitled Saving My Assassin. And she grew up in Romania. And she talks about the fact that she was very successful in Romania, and she actually went to school. And there, if you like socialism, education was free. You know, we're talking about, we want free college. And she said, well, yeah, college was free, and law school was free, but you pay a heavy price. Because they determine how you're going to practice law. They determine what kind of salary you're going to get. And they determine which cases you'll be allowed to take or which cases you will actually not be allowed to take. And that's what got her into trouble, because she began, after she became a Christian, to defend some of those believers under the brutal regime of Ceausescu. And you begin to realize we take a lot of freedom for granted today. So again, we see this. And here, one of the points that James Robinson makes is God values freedom so much, he even allows us to choose to reject him. I think that's the ultimate example of freedom. But the point is, what he's making the case is we've been losing our freedom today. Pastor Graham, I think, made that case. But you think about this in Isaiah 5, verse 20. It talks about people that call evil good and good evil. Well, that was a description of the southern kingdom of Judah at the time, in which God was saying that there was judgment coming. The northern kingdom had already been taken into exile by Assyrians. The southern kingdom about to be taken into exile by Babylon. But here, he's describing Israel. Isn't that interesting? And said, this is a nation that calls evil good and also calls good evil. Does that sound like our country today? So often it does as well. And so again, the need for us to stand for some kind of defense of freedom. Again, if you want some of these quotes, one of those will be available on the website. But this is a famous quote from Ronald Reagan. And if you'll permit me to read it, I think it reminds us of how fragile freedom is. Ronald Reagan said, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We don't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on to them to do the same. Or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States when men were free. It's a powerful quote, isn't it? But again, a reminder of that as well. Again, to stand for freedom requires for us to make sure that we have our attitudes right. And a very key quote you might want to put in your notes there is from the prophet Joel, Joel 2, verse 13, which he calls for a solemn assembly. This is something else I've been noticing. You know, when I have Pastor Graham in studio, by the way, he's going to be in my studio in July. So in a couple weeks from now, I'm going to give you that date and even see if some of you might like to come out. I'll even buy lunch if you want to come out and watch the interview. But one of the things I want to talk to him about, in addition to his Angels book, is if he's noticed what I've noticed, and that is more and more prayer events are taking place. And more of these are what are called solemn assemblies. Tony Evans, I just had a chance to talk with him this week by phone, has a solemn assembly taking place here in Dallas on September 25th that you might want to attend. Next week, there's a solemn assembly taking place in Washington, D.C., and you had a chance to hear from the individual just a couple of weeks ago who actually organized that because Pastor Graham brought him there. And I'm just seeing all sorts of places where people are really just taking time to pray. And Pastor Graham shared, and I'm glad he did, about, I'd heard there were 1,000 there, he said 900, but whatever, hundreds and hundreds on their knees. And you look out there, and it's the Gary Frasers, and it's the Jim Dobsons, and it's all sorts of individuals that are involved. It's Rodney and Stark, and it's Gary Fraser and Pastor Graham and Franklin Graham and all of them. They're all on their knees praying. That had to be kind of interesting to have Donald Trump watch that as well. But nevertheless, we see all that happening. And again, a time for us to rend our hearts and not our garments. Stop tearing our garments out of outreach, but instead rend our hearts, open our hearts to what God might have for us. And here, again, one of the arguments is that freedom must be protected. There's a story that's told of a woman that came up to Benjamin Franklin after they had finished the Constitutional Convention that was taking place in Philadelphia. And she comes up and says, "Well, doctor, what have we got? A republic or a monarchy?" And wisely, Benjamin Franklin said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And so the real question is that we are on the verge of losing freedom's blessings, so we need to do what we can to enjoy the freedom that we have and protect it in the future. One aspect of that is that in addition to even standing for freedom, we also need to fight against evil. And one of the other famous quotes comes from Martin Luther King Jr., who said, "He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetuate it. He who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it." So I think there's going to be a place not only to stand for righteousness, to stand for freedom, but also to exercise a prophetic voice to speak out evil. And then I wanted to give you this quote as well. This is from the book of Haggai. Consider your ways. We need to really begin to consider what we are doing and whether we are even indirectly participating in evil, and to begin to make wise choices. Finally, I thought I might give you a list of some of the absolutes he felt, 9 different absolutes that I thought would be helpful. And if you're taking some notes, you might write some of these down for just a minute, because I thought it would be illustrative of the kinds of things that we should stand for, he believes. And the first is to recognize that evil is real. You would think that's pretty obvious, but you know how many times it seems almost impossible for social commentators to say something is evil. Ronald Reagan got into lots of trouble when he referred to Russia as an evil empire. And even this day, it's hard to hear people say that radical Islam is evil. And these latest shootings and even the influence of radical Islamists around the world, I think, illustrate why we have to, first of all, come to the assumption that evil is real. Number 2, that ideas have consequences. That a belief system or a worldview can give you both good fruit or bad fruit. And so recognize that having the right way of thinking, having the right biblical mindset, is going to lead to things which are positive. Number 3, that we are spiritual beings. I thought that was interesting because of the idea that God exists. And because we are rational beings, because we're created in the image of God, we can discern truth and we can understand biblical truth and apply it. Number 4, that the majority is not always right. There was a real fear on the part of the framers, and again, this could be an assignment for some of you, especially to come into 4th of July weekend, and that is, you might want to read maybe one of the Federalist Papers. You know, you may have never read the Federalist Papers, and you don't even have to go out and buy them because they're online. I would suggest if you wanted to read one, read Federalist Paper number 10. Federalist Paper number 10 was written by James Madison. And there you see him concerned that we might have these factions. They feared this idea of a pure democracy, what they oftentimes called a mobocracy. Because you know what? Sometimes 51% of people can be wrong, right? Sometimes 90% of people can be wrong. Remember Francis Schaeffer saying that one person standing for biblical truth on biblical foundations should outweigh 90% of people that are in error. And there is a sense in which sometimes the mob can be wrong, and we recognize that the majority isn't always right. Number five, truth withstands a debate. There's a famous quote that says, you know, the gospel is like a lion. It just needs to be uncaged and let it go out and defend itself. And there is a sense in which that is true, but also those things which are true and right and pure, eventually they're going to stand the rigors of some kind of debate. Number six, the idea that people matter most. You know, another quote that comes from Galatians 5, which is kind of my assignment for you to use this week in your quiet time. You also see that Paul pulls away from the golden rule here, and he reminds us that you should love your neighbor as yourself. Number seven, equality is not sameness. There's no two people that are alike, no two snowflakes that are alike. That yes, we believe in equality, but we also recognize that there are different gifts and different callings. Matter of fact, you might even put down 1 Corinthians 12 there to even illustrate how very different that is. Number eight, if government doesn't serve, it will enslave, and that is the importance of sometimes keeping a government within their God-given responsibilities and keep it under control. And then finally, truth has a source, that the timeless truths of the Bible has stood the test of time, and certainly that is the case. So those are just a couple of things that are sort of some of the absolutes that might guide us as we begin to think about government. But he also has some chapters in which he talks about smaller government makes bigger citizens, and that is, we should be willing to recognize that when government is small, our freedom is greater, and that's the freedom to preach the gospel, it's a freedom to do good works, and as a result, there are more opportunities for the church. And yet reminds us that how many times do we see, for example, the Jews were willing to put themselves back under bondage. You know, after they left Egypt, you have a statement there in Numbers 14 where they ask, wouldn't it be better if we went back to Egypt? Isn't that amazing? And again, of course, you have the most famous passage there in 1 Samuel 8, where they say, give us a king. Samuel's saying, you don't want a king. No, give us a king. You know, we want to be put under bondage. And there's such a tendency sometimes to do so, and so to recognize that is the case. And so oftentimes when we question things like politically correct ideas or challenge some of the secularist ideas, it's real easy to be branded with a label. You know, you're a bigot, you're a homophobe, you're a racist, you're an Islamophobe, or something like that. Then he has a chapter where he talks about small God leads to big government. In other words, if you have no belief in God or a God is insignificant, then government takes over all sorts of responsibilities. It takes over the family and it takes over the church. It begins to tell everybody what kinds of things they can do. And so again, it illustrates some of the challenges we face. He quotes from a book, I think we have time to go through this real quickly, of seven kind of doctrines that sometimes happen in the government. And one is the doctrine of using deliberately mushy words and terminology. This comes from a book that he quotes from, actually. Or the doctrine of never enough. There's never enough money, there's never enough rules, there's never enough bureaucracy, and how the government has gotten so much larger. Then you have the doctrine of the federal government always defines neighbor. In other words, it says, well, you're an illegal immigrant is a neighbor, and so you have to treat it there, or in some cases even tells you how to command and commands you how to love the neighbor. And it gets into questions that we've been dealing with lately about transgendered persons. Then you have the doctrine of results don't matter, only good intentions. A good example of that would be the poverty programs. In the last 30 plus years, 3.5 decades, if you want to define it as such, we've had poverty programs, which have spent, if you count all of the programs and all of the various incidental programs, probably spent anywhere close to about $18 trillion. Think about that for a minute. And yet the poverty level is pretty much the way it was back in the 1960s. Now, poverty is different in the 21st century than it was in the 20th century. But you would think at some point you'd say, you know, this isn't working. Maybe we need to try something different. If you were in business, you were spending that kind of money, wouldn't you try something different? I would think so. And it's just an illustration again. But because there were good intentions, sometimes we never really change what we're doing. The doctrine of rules about rules. You know, other people make the rules. You don't make the rules, but you have to live under the rules, and those rules can change at a moment's notice. And then finally, the doctrine of only federal government can solve these problems. The answer to every social problem isn't, well, what can individuals do? What can private groups do? What can the church do? No, what the government can do. And so just a lot of different interesting things that come out of the book. But finally, in the last few minutes, I thought we'd spend some time also talking about the social and cultural solutions. And this is one place where James Robison has not only a tremendous heart for the unborn, he has his own experience. If you're not familiar, James Robison is a perfect example of why you do not want to abort a child conceived as a result of rape. If you're not familiar, James Robison's mother, when she was about 40 years of age and had never married, actually was cleaning houses for different individuals to support herself. And one of these individuals raped her and she was pregnant. She went to a doctor who refused to do the abortion. So she finally gave birth to James Robison. Now, if you wanted to have an example of why you might not want to abort even a child conceived of rape, there is a great example of this man who he had some connection with later on, was an alcoholic and spent most of his life in prison. You know, if there had ever been a reasonable justification for abortion, it would be a woman who has no husband, basically no family, who would have to raise this child by herself. Nevertheless, James Robison has such an incredible heart for the unborn because, as he points out, we'll talk about this in just a minute, if Planned Parenthood had been around when he was conceived, 4 generations of Robison family would not exist. But again, he also raises something else, and that is, you know, during the first Democratic debate, you might remember this, one of the candidates was asked, do black lives matter or do all lives matter? And I think we should say all lives do matter. Matter of fact, here's a quote from him. He said, we must proclaim that the 12-week-old unborn baby sucking her thumb, the handicapped infant, the elderly widower hooked up to an oxygen tank, and the people we don't think contribute to society are valuable simply by virtue of being what? Human. Because they're created in the image of God. And so again, you know, he talks about the fact that many people pay lip service to some of these hot button ideas. They'll talk about human rights or women's health or caring for the poor, but they ignore the first issue, and that is what? The right to life. And again, we have to applaud Pastor Graham for the fact that when he came here from Florida, one of the first things he did, and I remember when we were there over there at Hillcrest, he wanted to make sure that we'd have a pregnancy center, and we've had this Prestonwood Pregnancy Center ever since that time. And James Robison says, you know, the undercover videos of Planned Parenthood should be enough to cause people to stop and think. But as he said, if Planned Parenthood had been active at the time of his birth, he probably wouldn't have had 4 generations of Robison families. He says, until Americans correctly choose this day whom they will serve, back to Joshua 24, which we looked at a couple weeks ago, they're going to be slaves of out-of-control appetites, compulsive behaviors, lacks of sensitivity, diminishing compassion, bad judgment, and ever-increasing unbearable bondage. Only Jesus can break the shackles, set the captives free, and give us hope, peace, and security. So he has quite a bit, obviously, you might imagine, to say about life. Let me move on to a couple others, and that is the issue of families. One of the big issues we're going to be facing in the 21st century is what it means to be a family, what marriage really means. And he points out the fact that Jim Garlow, who was one of the other people, interestingly enough, that was that event with Donald Trump on Tuesday, has said that oftentimes you hear people when he'll raise questions about the redefinition of the family, will say, well, that ship has sailed. And Jim Garlow has this great idea. He says, yeah, well, that ship has sailed, but you know, sometimes those ships that have sailed are doomed to sink, like the Titanic. Matter of fact, there are many examples in the past where courts and culture have sailed the ship in what? The wrong direction. Slavery and civil rights. Just because the culture has done it doesn't make it right. And so the key verse there, which you might want to put in your notes, would be Acts 5:29. We must obey God rather than men. That was a verse based upon the fact that they told them not to go out and share their faith. And Peter and others said, nope, we cannot do that. We must obey God rather than men. Also, one of the things that he talks about, having grown up without a father, has given him a great sensitivity to the fatherlessness of America. He says, we recognize that there's only one way to fill the gaping hole in the human heart that is created by fatherlessness, and that is with the presence of the living God. Matter of fact, he said, I wish there had been a dad in my life, but I'm so grateful to know that the Father can, to know the Father anyone can know. That is, of course, our Father God. Finally, we might also talk about this idea of unnatural disasters. Of course, we have lots of natural disasters. We had lots of rain. Now we have seemingly drought, and we have tornadoes, and we have hurricanes and earthquakes and all the rest. But we have also what you might call unnatural disasters. Uncontrolled, unbalanced budgets. Excessive spending for unsustainable programs that have undermined fathers, families, and communities. Exorbitant, misdirected taxation that saps wealth-creating enterprises. And again, just recognize that these are the things we face today in this 21st century. So how do we respond? Well, a couple of quick points. First of all, he says it's time for the church to draw a line in the sand, a line by which and beyond which we will not go. We can't always be concerned about what happens outside of the church, but at least inside the church, we should say these are non-negotiables. And as a nation, we certainly should also call for that kind of response as well. We've lost our moral compass. We're losing our freedom. And if nothing else, one of the issues that we certainly should stand for is the fact that marriage is inherently a union between one man and one woman, beneficial to children, and is also the first building block of the social order. So if nothing else, it's a real call for us again to stand for righteousness, to speak truth to the culture, to speak against evil, and to call sinners to repentance. And that's certainly what Preston Wood is all about. So in conclusion, here are 6 points real quickly, if you want to take some notes, that I kind of think summarize the book very quickly. And I'll turn it back to Parker. And the first is that we are facing an ever-increasing size of the government and control, things that we would not have imagined even just a few years ago. And this is happening because of we, the voters, but also because of the representatives we've sent to Washington, and in many cases destroying the possibility of any real progress. Number two, we have this rapidly growing debt and an ever-increasing call for more taxes as well. And these are a bondage to destroy any hope for economic recovery and any kind of stability. But then the third one comes back to us, and that is, he says, the lack of involvement on part of Christians is diminishing our contribution to our nation's well-being and, in fact, contributing to its downfall. I was waiting for Gary Fraser to announce, because I know that Pastor Graham has given his organization, United in Purpose, the freedom to actually go through our membership rolls and then pair that to those individuals who are registered to vote. And they don't actually tell people, obviously you can't tell how people vote, but you can just see how many people inside the church are registered to vote. They've done this for other churches, and pastors who are convinced that most of their congregation are registered to vote find out that sometimes only 50%, 60%, that's in a good church, are registered to vote. Well, I think, as Pastor Graham points out, this is known as throwing away your stewardship responsibility. And there are going to be some very important elections taking place this year in the United States. First of all, of course, we have an election of a president and a vice president. We have 34 U.S. Senate races. We don't happen to have one in this state, but we do in 34 other states have 34 U.S. Senate races. We have 435 races for the House of Representatives. We have 44 states that have elections for their state representatives, including we have one here for 150 members of the Texas House and 31 Texas senators. There are 13 different governor's races, not in this state, but in others. And then you work your way all the way down from president all the way down to what? Dog catcher. And you end up with almost 35,000 different races that are taking place. With that opportunity, and to find that in a typical church, you're lucky if 50% of the church is registered to vote, do we have a problem? I think we do. And just imagine if more Christians were registered to vote, and then those Christians went out and voted intelligently, not just for the presidency, but all the way down for all those particular races, you could see that would be a remarkable change in where America is today. Number four, the interpretation of founding principles is opening up to great deception, the misinterpretation. And so next week, we'll talk a little bit about some of those principles. What did the founders intend? What did the framers write into the Constitution? And what can we learn maybe from the first Great Awakening and the second Great Awakening and how godly men and women have attempted to apply those principles to government? We've not embraced the value of human life. We just talked about that in a minute and how, again, we live in a culture that in many ways is no longer valuing life inside the womb, but then that has led to all sorts of reevaluation of life outside the womb as well. And then finally, we've lost the importance of family and marriage. Well, that was kind of a quick book review of a book that I would recommend to you, and it's called The Stream. I would also encourage you, if you want to get a good alternative source of news, information, and commentary, go to thestream.org. You'll find some great material there as well. But if nothing else, I did not know Pastor Graham was going to talk about a world, and especially a nation, that is going the wrong direction. But if this gives you at least an idea of how we as believers need to respond, I hope that it would be helpful to you. Parker?